Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we discuss coverage of the week's news. Today, we are spending the hour on the presidential primaries. For the past few weeks, actually months, many independent media outlets have run stories about the corporate media downplaying and even ignoring Bernie Sanders. After he won the New Hampshire primary, the broadcast media and cable pundits couldn't ignore him, but many were more intrigued by Amy Klobuchar coming in third place. On Tuesday, the Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan ran a piece called "The Media Keep Falling in Love with Anybody But Bernie Sanders." Then there's this simplistic far-left versus center frame recently heard on NPR and capitalism versus socialism frame recently heard on Meet the Press. We will also talk about the media's erasure of Elizabeth Warren, what is happening there, the Amy Klobuchar surge narrative and her record, Michael Bloomberg's stop and frisk policy and the hundreds of millions he's spending. In fact, The Intercept's Li Fong just tweeted last night that Bloomberg is now spending $4.5 million a day just on advertising. So much airtime is spent on these primaries, but most of it is not on actual issues. So there's a lot to talk about. Today, we're joined by three guests. Derica Purnell is a human rights lawyer and columnist at The Guardian. She provides legal assistance and training to community groups working to end police violence or close prisons through an abolitionist framework. Derica Purnell's writing has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times and In These Times. Hi, Derica. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, of course. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Branko Marchetich, a staff writer at Jacobin, contributor to In These Times, and a Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting fellow. Branko is author of the book Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. If you're in the Bay Area, he'll be speaking on Monday at 7 p.m. at the Artist Run Gallery BEL4B in Oakland. That's 184 10th Street. Hi, Branko. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And John Alsop is a freelance journalist. He writes the Columbia Journalism Review's newsletter, The Media Today. John Alsop's writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Nation, and other publications. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Derica, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Oh, wow. Well, the biggest news that I saw this week was the leak. Well, it feels unfair to call it a leak, but it was Benjamin Dixon's exposure of the Michael Bloomberg speech at the Aspen Institute. I don't know if that's positive news, but it definitely caught my eye.
Well, and what it did is it got even the mainstream media to ask Bloomberg about stop and frisk, about redlining. So it really did really change the narrative.
Yes.
Right. Well, thank you for that. We will definitely talk about Bloomberg because you've been writing about him for The Guardian. What about you, Branko? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
One really interesting story was by Greg Miller at the Washington Post. The title, at least online, is The Intelligence Coup of the Century. And it's basically about how the CIA and the NSA for decades owned this encryption company that they were surreptitiously using. You know, they were selling encryption technology to adversaries of the U.S. And of the Five Eyes Alliance that they were then used to spy on them. I think something like 40% of the diplomatic cables and other foreign intercepts that the U.S. government was receiving during those decades came from this this kind of ploy, and there was a set of documents basically that came out that revealed this. So I thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, that does sound fascinating. Thank you for that, and we'll put that up at yourcallradio.org right after the show. John Alsop, what caught your attention this week?
Well, I'm sure there's been a ton of really great reporting, not about the election, but I have had my head kind of so wired into that that I also have a story about Mike Bloomberg. It was in the New York Times by Taylor Lorenz, and it was about his commissioning of just incredibly bizarre memes on Instagram. And I think Taylor does a really great job of covering the kind of internet hellscape in which our politics now plays out and you know, culture and society too. But, you know, some of the memes that Bloomberg has been trying to push across, I think that the line is that he's trying to create like a self-aware, ironic character around himself. I thought it was just kind of a neat distillation of really, you know, how artificial so much of this current campaign in this current moment is.
Well, and I'd like to just get all of you to give us an overview of what you think of the coverage. I think what stands out for me is the simplistic frames, you know, far left versus center, capitalism versus socialism. I mean, it's just so simplistic. And then they go to voters and get sound bites. And I'm talking mostly about broadcast and cable shows. They go to voters and get sound bites, but you just don't hear much about actual issues. Derica, when you look at all of the airtime given to the primaries, what really stands out for you the most in how it's being covered?
Yes, I mean, I completely agree with the initial framing of the conversation that there's a, it seems to be a dedicated erasure of Bernie Sanders' progress, so much so that I remember one pundit saying that Amy Klobuchar coming in third would be the best thing that could come out of New Hampshire, right? Like a third place slot. And just to see how all the math is being drawn across the map, if we can just combine and look at the polling out, the polling data for Buttigieg, and we add that with the polling data for Klobuchar, if we add that with the fourth place support for Biden, maybe we can, you know, see that most people who are interested in voting, you know, this next time around are actually moderate. I thought that was just kind of absurd. It just seems like a dedicated practice of erasing Bernie Sanders on one end and then Elizabeth Warren on the other. What's particularly unfortunate is that even the arguments defy, like, some of the simple logic around math. And so I saw a lot of pundits comparing Bernie Sanders' polling data and election results compared to Hillary Clinton in 2016, where it was just two of them in the field, compared to his turnout and support in 2020 when there's eight more candidates, right? And so even the math that's being used is not talked about with integrity. You know, there's just no type of, like, serious consideration and how much this field has shifted since 2016. And the story, when people are talking about Bernie Sanders, they say, you know, people don't want a revolution. People don't want to tear down and remake the system. You know, who is moderate, undecided, independent America going to be for? And every time we hear, it's a wait and see. So on the one hand, when Bernie Sanders walks away victorious in Iowa and New Hampshire, it's like, oh, wow, yeah, of course, there's, you know, these are only 2% of the delegates to be awarded. And then on the flip side, if he would have lost, the conversation would have been, no presidential candidate has ever seriously had a shot without winning both New Hampshire and Iowa. Hmm. So it's a lose-lose situation.
What about you, Bronco? What stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with the kind of playing down of Bernie Sanders that's kind of gone on throughout the whole of last year and really even in the wake of New Hampshire. But I really want to focus on the kind of use of polling as this measure of the race. You know, I actually did a study for In These Times about MSNBC's coverage of the race over 2 months late in 2019. And among other things, sort of, you know, who got favorable coverage, who didn't, who was mentioned most, that kind of thing. One of the just things that you can't help but notice when you go through all this coverage is that it is, at least in MSNBC, obsessed with polling, obsessed with what the latest numbers are up and down. And, you know, I mean, obviously polling can give us a lot of indications about where the race is going. It gives us trends. It can be something that's pretty accurate. Also, it can be very inaccurate. But the problem is the way that campaign coverage in this election, and, you know, you could apply this to previous elections as well, has been centered on whatever the latest polls are when they're, you know, a year or even 6 months out. A lot of people aren't even paying attention to the race. A lot of people haven't made up their minds. Sometimes the polls will actually reflect that. Some polls will say, you know, 60% of those people who said, you know, Biden, for example, actually haven't made up their mind. 40% of those said Warren in the sort of late to middle of last year had made up their minds. That stuff wouldn't really get reported as much. But nonetheless, it would still structure the coverage. It would still, you know, Joe Biden was presented as this formidable front runner, as this electable candidate for the entire year. And I kind of feel like with this collapse in both Iowa and New Hampshire, the media's kind of been caught with its pants down a little bit because they have focused so much on the polling, on the latest polling results. And, you know, of course, the voters on the ground have not really reflected that. So I think, you know, going forward in future campaigns, I think it's worth thinking about you know, what is the value of polls? How can they be responsibly used? And also, to what extent should we let them really drive the structure of the coverage of the campaign?
Hmm. And you can find the detailed analysis that Bronco did on MSNBC's coverage for In These Times at yourcallradio.org. This week, Chuck Todd is being heavily criticized because he characterized Bernie Sanders' online following as, quote, digital brown shirts. And then you had Chris Matthews going on a tirade against socialism, saying, I don't know what Bernie means by socialism. One week it's Denmark. Well, what does he think of Castro? That's a great question. And there's so many quotes just from MSNBC in Bronco's piece. And then GQ is out with a piece today called Why Does Mainstream Media Keep Attacking Bernie as He Wins? John, what stands out for you in the coverage so far? I should say you write a daily newsletter called Media Today for the Columbia Journalism Review, and every article you write has so many links to other media outlets. So you really follow how media cover this primary.
Yes, I have to do that. And it at the moment is, you know, there's a lot to take in. Clearly Bronco is right about this reliance on polling. I would just add to what he said that the weekend before the Iowa caucuses, the final Des Moines Register poll, everyone was waiting with bated breath for that, and they ended up scrapping it because of at least one irregularity that was reported by Pete Buttigieg's campaign. CNN, which had been involved with the poll as well, had scheduled an hour-long special just to discuss that one poll, which they then had to cancel. And so, you know, it was kind of the, I don't want to say the exception that proves the rule necessarily, but kind of the hole that was left in their coverage, and then the coverage of everyone who was going to talk about that poll on every other network did really kind of demonstrate in the negative the point that Bronco is making. Clearly, this reliance on polling and sort of horse race coverage is not new, and it's something we unfortunately see every cycle. But I think something that is very striking this year to me is the extent to which we're talking about electability. Again, that's not a new conversation, but I've seen a ton of articles, both in print and then also segments on TV and podcasts, really making the case that the Democratic electorate this year is so anxious about beating Trump, thinks that the stakes are so high, that they are really concerned above all else with who can beat him. Now, that may very well be true, that there is that preoccupation to a greater extent than in the past. But I feel like in coverage, it's sort of taken as license for us to then talk only about electability and to sort of leave policy as a secondary consideration. Obviously, just because voters are obsessing over something doesn't mean that that's all we have to cover. And I think more fundamentally, it also sort of neglects the key role that we in the media play in shaping people's perceptions of electability, right? People don't reach those judgments in a vacuum. And if you are going to these early primaries and caucuses, and your primary consideration is who can beat Trump, and you have spent the last week watching cable news, for example, the chatter about electability that's been going on cable news will inform how you vote. And very often those conversations are, as Bronco said, just based on polling, which is a partial snapshot. Worse, they're very often based on no data at all, but just sort of punditry, which be mired in conventional wisdom. Oh, Bernie Sanders isn't electable. These were the same people, of course, who said Donald Trump wasn't electable in 2016. So I think that there's the risk of a vicious cycle there. And I think that given people's obvious anxiety about beating Trump, that is probably a greater factor this election than we've seen, in the past.
That is John Alsop. He writes the Columbia Journalism Review's newsletter, The Media Today. Bronco Marchetich is a staff writer at Jacobin, contributor to In These Times, and a Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting fellow. Derica Purnell is a human rights lawyer, columnist at The Guardian. She's also written for The New York Times and In These Times. Derica, I know you have to leave us in 10 minutes to catch a train, so I want to talk about the reporting that you have done on Michael Bloomberg. You mentioned the audio that Benjamin Dixon released a couple of days ago. He's got a political podcast. And just to let people know, this audio was released from a speech Bloomberg gave at the Aspen Institute in 2015. And I'll read just a little bit. We would play the audio, but it's kind of hard to hear. He says 95% Murderers and murder victims fit one MO. You can just take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male, minorities, 16 to 25. That's true in New York. That's true in virtually every city. And that's where the real crime is. You've got to get the guns out of the hands of the people that are being killed. You want to spend the money on a lot of cops in the streets. Put the cops where the crime is. So again, that's from a Bloomberg speech in 2015 at the Aspen Institute. This is now getting a lot of attention, Derica. And in fact, you wrote a piece months ago saying that an apology for stop and frisk is just too late. What do you think of how the media are now covering stop and frisk?
Can you repeat? I'm sorry, you cut off right at the end of the question.
Yeah. What do you think of how the media are now covering stop and frisk?
Oh, well, so a couple of things. I think that it took a couple of days for the media to really catch on and take the audio seriously. When it first aired on cable news, when it aired on CNN, the talking heads were just calling into question the veracity or the legitimacy of the speech. I think because Benjamin Dixon has talked about being a Bernie supporter, but has been sitting on YouTube for 5 years. You know, I can only imagine how his campaign must be scrambling through YouTube right now, trying to comb through and figure out what else is out there. Especially since this second speech has surfaced about him supporting or reminiscing about the days where redlining was in vogue. You know, but I think what's happening is that the media is so interested on reducing the conversation of the problematic nature of a Michael Bloomberg presidency to the issue of stop and frisk, which I think is sufficiently, it's like enough to say that he should not be president of the United States. You know, what is a Michael Bloomberg ICE going to look like? What is a Michael Bloomberg DOJ going to look like? What is Michael Bloomberg, you know, policing grants going to look like? So it's not like, oh, you know, 5 years ago I had these ideas about policing and black people's bodies, but it's just that shows up in policies, you know? So an apology that comes right before you announce a presidential bid, it's just not enough. Like, it's not enough. And it's not enough, and there's nothing that he can do to make up for the repeated violations of, you know, black men, brown men, poor men, standing on sidewalks, on corners, on top of police cars, with their legs spread, with officers groping, patting down their arms, patting down their inner thighs, their genitals. There's no amount of apology that he could do to make up for that. So it's not just, oh, I got this thing wrong, I'm so sorry, guys. But he doubled down on it after he left the office. You know, this is a speech that was just 5 years ago, 2015, in the height of the Black Lives Matter movement that was calling to question police violence. He said those words. You know, so the media is, I think, now getting to a point where they have to figure out how to reckon with it. At the same time, the media is also pointing to some of the black support that he's getting, and I don't know if we're doing our best to reconcile the contradictions between some black mayors who are supporting him and the policies that he did to hurt the black people that those mayors are leading. Hmm.
And to add a couple facts to this, Derica, now that a lot of numbers are being are coming out once again, GQ has a story. Michael Bloomberg tried to bury that racist recording by Luke Darby. It says in 2011, when current presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg was mayor of New York City, and we should say he was a Republican mayor back then, there were 158,406 black teenagers and men between the ages of 14 and 24. That same year, New York Police Department officers stopped and searched black males in that age range 168,000 times. So these numbers are just staggering. A Guardian article that I found that was written a couple of years ago focuses on one man who was stopped over 100 times. He started being stopped when he was just 13 years old. His name is Keyshawn Harley.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, the quantitative assessment of stop and frisk is obviously horrible. More black men have been stopped in New York City than the number of black men who reside in New York City, right? It's just that. But qualitatively, I mean, what's so unfortunate is that we have taken the time to acknowledge how sexual violence and gender-based violence, especially in the Me Too era, what it means for someone to be personally violated Right. That same level of empathy qualitatively is just not giving to poor black and brown men. Mm. It's just not. And so we can listen to one story of someone who's a victim of a white man who is in power. And we, fortunately, we have gotten to a position where we're calling them out and removing them from power. But here we're talking quantitatively about hundreds of thousands of stops. And just like the one story of that violation is not enough. And that's unfortunate.
There's a hashtag going around called My Bloomberg Story. One woman said in 2002, her dad was stopped and frisked for having a Muslim name. He was detained without a phone call to his family. We couldn't report him missing. That night, I went from hospital to hospital to see if unidentified bodies were admitted. And she writes, I was just 12. So, Derica, now that this audio is out, the redlining comment is out, how do you think the media should cover these issues from here, as Bloomberg is spending $4.5 million a day? And the next Democratic debate is on Wednesday. The DNC was talking about changing the rules to allow Bloomberg to take part in the debates, even though, unlike Kamala Harris, Joaquin Castro, Cory Booker, he didn't have to abide by any of those other rules in the earlier debates because he didn't take part.
Right, he could just literally buy his way. And I think it was the DNC chairperson who said, well, if people are critical of the rules change, then they should show up and vote, because that's how you respond to a billionaire spending $4.5 million a day. You know, so I think what is also unfortunate is that what we are seeing is Democrats, even though he was a Republican at the time, I mean, the flip-flop is a whole other conversation, but not only did he engage in stop and frisk, not only did he engage in redlining, he was responsible for the surveillance of black and brown Muslims in New Jersey and New York. You know, the students who were regularly surveilled, the mosques were regularly surveilled. Like, it's the local version of a travel ban. And it's worse because all of that data, that doesn't go away once the Muslim surveillance program ends. You know, so what is it? What is a Michael Bloomberg Islamophobia going to, how is it going to manifest through policy and in practice? Hmm. Right? He refused initially to settle with black NY New York firefighters as they were saying, look, we're being discriminated against. The test that you're using is racist. And he doubled down. So it's just not like, oh, there's just stop and frisk here, a little red lining there. If you look within the totality of his policies, that's the kind of mayor that he is. And so I'm just not convinced. You know, we, for the last few years, have been saying the names of people who have been victims of police violence, of Islamophobia, of, you know, the exponential rise in rent and gentrification. We can't continue to tell those stories when they're popular in media, but then go and promote the person to the highest office in the country as if those two things are disconnected. Hmm.
Well, Derica, I know you have to catch a train, so thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
We'd love to have you back. Thank you. That is Derica Purnell. She's a human rights lawyer and a columnist at The Guardian, and she's got a couple pieces on Michael Bloomberg and other issues around the primaries. You can find those pieces at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will continue speaking with John Alsop, freelance journalist. He writes the Columbia Journalism Review's newsletter, The Media Today, and Bronco Marchatic, staff writer at Jacobin, contributor to In These Times, and a Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. You know, when I was putting this show together, because there's so much to talk about, I think that it would be a good idea if before Super Tuesday, because so many states are voting then, we might do shows on all of the candidates to look at their records. So if you think that's a good idea, we'd love to hear from you, because if we do that, we're going to have to cancel some shows and then reschedule. So if you'd like us to do shows on every candidate to look at their records and their policies, please email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Bronco Marchatic, staff writer at Jacobin, contributor to In These Times, and a Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. Bronco is author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. He'll be speaking on Monday at 7 p.m. in Oakland, 184 10th Street at the B4 Bell 4B artist-run gallery. John Alsop is a freelance journalist writing the Columbia Journalism Review's newsletter, The Media Today. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What really stands out for you and all of the media coverage of the primaries. One more question for each of you on Michael Bloomberg. At a press conference on Tuesday, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, as far as Bloomberg is concerned, I think that his involvement in this campaign will be a positive one. NPR had San Francisco Mayor London Breed on earlier this week, I believe, or last week, and they asked about stop and frisk. And she said, quote, I think that unfortunately it occurred and there isn't a politician alive that hasn't made a mistake. So I just wonder, John, we're hearing Bloomberg stories on their own. I mean, he's getting so much media attention. One of the reasons could be because he's spending, well, the latest numbers, according to The Intercept's Lee Fong, $363 million just on radio and cable news ads.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. One thing I have noticed since Bloomberg belatedly got into the race late last year, is that in the sort of political press, the kind of insider political press, if you will, the coverage of Bloomberg has very often been about his advertising. The extent to which he is spending money undoubtedly is extremely significant, both for its, you know, effect on American democracy, and also in a narrower sense, because it really is kind of extraordinary by the standards of any campaign of recent memory. So I'm not saying it's a totally illegitimate thing to talk about, but the articles tend to be, wow, Bloomberg has spent, you know, X amount of money. He's inundating the airwaves in California, for example, rather than, uniformly, is this healthy? Should someone be able to spend this much money on advertising? And I think because of his lack of participation in these early primaries and caucuses, he's sort of skated past some of the substantive policy-based scrutiny until, I think, this week. And I think that his kind of rapid rise in national polls has been one factor behind this kind of recent flurry of stories on more substantive grounds about him. But I think what he has essentially been able to do is kind of get fluffy coverage about his big spending campaign, skate past more serious scrutiny because he isn't really in play in these early states, which have consumed so much media attention in recent months. And what he has been able to do as a consequence is kind of plant his preferred narrative directly in the minds of voters. You're watching the news and it comes to an ad break and you see a commercial for Michael Bloomberg and then you see one in the next ad break. I mean, some of the sort of saturation of his ads is really remarkable. And I think that, it's perfectly legitimate to think and to argue that if someone is kind of getting that much free publicity, free narrative creation, you have to work doubly hard to ensure they are properly scrutinized. And I think what we've seen instead, really, is that his paid media has driven an enormous amount of free media. And I think, we gave Donald Trump a lot of free media. He called it earned media, of course, but we gave him a lot of free media in 2016. And I think it would be a shame to kind of repeat that mistake again with Bloomberg. But I do think that has kind of colored what we've seen about him so far.
And Bronco, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty breathtaking, just how this colossal amount of money that he's put towards buying ads has really resulted in, big polling boosts, in surveys and everything. I mean, we often think about wealth and political power in terms of donating to parties and candidates. But I think we rarely think of wealth as the extreme wealth that Bloomberg has and people like him as a form of political power in themselves. Bloomberg was able to use his wealth first to parlay into a political career as mayor. Of course, now he is running for president. He is not just that he's donating to candidates and he's donating to, groups, grassroots groups that are then sort of out of loyalty and out of financial incentive endorsing him. That's one issue. But it's also, even without the campaign donations, I mean, the colossal amounts of money that he's spending on ads, that in itself, as others have pointed out, I've not invented this this point, but that in itself is a huge conflict of interest for the corporate media. Because, I mean, these are unheard of numbers. And so they really have a big financial incentive if they want to keep getting huge amounts of ad money from Bloomberg to potentially give him favorable coverage. I mean, you know, obviously he is getting scrutiny, but we don't know how this is going to play out. And I think it's really alarming. And I think it's very key to understand that wealth isn't just wealth. It is also a form of political power in itself. And it can be really threatening to democracy, whether you have the loose campaign finance regulations that the U.S. currently does or not.
And I just want to mention, just because I really believe in policies, on Democracy Now! This morning, Juan Gonzalez said that he finds it astonishing that Democrats and progressives might rally behind Bloomberg. He said, look at the privatization of public parks under Bloomberg, the privatization of public schools through expansion of charter schools, massive subsidies for commercial development in the city while rents skyrocketed. He said this is classic neoliberalism. So we will definitely continue to follow Bloomberg, and we're getting a lot of emails saying, please do a show on all of the candidates so we can learn more. So we will definitely, hopefully, do that in the next month. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me on, and welcome to your guests. I just want to mention, Bernie Sanders came out with his plan on the media and on journalism back in August. And as a matter of fact, it was in the Columbia Journalism Review, which I believe one of your guests represents. And in there, he laid it all out. Essentially, he's going to ratchet back the Telecommunications Act of 1996. He wants to bring back antitrust legislation. He wants to break up the media conglomerates. He wants to break up the social media aggregators. He wants to fund money into local broadcasting and community radio and investigative journalism. He talks about, in that article, putting a tax on ads that are done by the media conglomerates and the large multinationals that are in the media. And they're scared to death of this. You didn't hear anything about his media journalism plan, because this is going to break up the monopolies. This is the kiss of death, and the gravy train ends for corporate media. Over.
Wow. You know, thank you so much for calling in. I did not even know this. Columbia Journalism Review ran an op-ed, Bernie Sanders, on his plan for journalism. This is really incredible. I mean, he talks about wanting to get rid of the Telecom Act, which was signed under Bill Clinton. I mean, Bronco, this is a great example. You know, we spend so much time reading about these candidates, NPR's on all the day, watching cable channels. I have never heard of this from Bernie's campaign.
Yeah, I remember when this came out, and I think part of it is the and also, you know, as the caller said, was promptly sort of ignored. Partly, I think, you know, campaign coverage is driven by narratives. And for the for much of the media, the narrative is that Sanders, because he is critical of media coverage, because he is critical of the corporate structure of media, he sort of, there's this tendency to kind of very, I think, lazily describe him as kind of a left-wing Trump. Oh, you know, he's doing a Trump thing by criticizing the media. If you actually look at Sanders' record in his career, from the time he was mayor to now, he's a small D Democrat. And so, you know, while he does not believe in the corporate sort of control of media, I think he's very supportive of journalism in general. But, you know, I think the other thing about this is that, not just the sort of media narratives, but also part of what Sanders identifies in that op-ed and elsewhere is that in the U.S. there's this more conservative idea of freedom, which is freedom from the government, right? And you know, don't get me wrong, we need to have a clear separation between sort of the government or at least government control and the press, and that's part of why the prosecution of Julian Assange is so alarming. But there's also another dimension to this. And to its credit, the Columbia Journalism Review has actually covered this, which is how, for example, private equity firms and hedge funds are kind of destroying small community newspapers, by coming in and sort of just stripping them down, taking as much as they can and just sort of taking them for what they're worth and then leaving them a hollowed out shell. And in the process, even engaging in their own sort of media suppression when those newspapers try and report about these companies, their parent companies, stripping them and sort of hauling them out. So I think, I think that op-ed, it's critical, I think, to understanding how the media treats and has treated Sanders throughout this campaign. But I think it's also in itself kind of important to realize that there are multiple kind of threats to the free press in the U.S. It's not just a repressive and authoritarian or potentially authoritarian government, but also how corporations and the free market can undermine it too.
There was a good piece in Vox by Matthew Iglesias called Mainstream Democrats Should Not Fear Bernie Sanders, basically saying exactly what you said, Bronco. His vision is really not that radical. He's a small D Democrat. And both of you live outside the country. I was just curious what people in your part of the world think of Bernie, because when I went to Europe last year, most European political conversations I had, they said, we don't understand this left-wing thing about Bernie. He's a mainstream politician here.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm sort of split between two non-US countries. I live in Toronto, but I'm from New Zealand originally. Definitely people like him. There's a skepticism about whether he can win, because I think there is this very deeply ingrained narrative, not just in the US, but really all across the Western world, that, you know, being too far left is sort of electoral poison. Of course, ignoring, you know, the history of the early to mid 20th century when politics, the political center was shifted way to the left of where it is now. But I think definitely people in New Zealand and in Canada, certainly where they have a form of single payer healthcare, they do find the kind of it's just, for example, the media questioning of Medicare for All, sort of presenting it as this radical idea that will destroy healthcare, that will lead to these terrible outcomes. People are very baffled by it, because while New Zealand does not have that kind of universal healthcare, we certainly have a pretty robust public health system. And people kind of don't understand how someone can see getting the medical treatment you need as a threat to freedom. And you'll find that in the UK as well. A lot of British people are baffled by the way Sanders gets attacked for, you know, wanting to kind of, you know, quote unquote, take over healthcare in the US and abolish the private health insurance industry. I think if you talk to a lot of people in the UK who deal with the NHS, they would be baffled by this fondness for private health insurance instead of just, you know, being able to go to a doctor for free, and being treated no matter what condition you might have, without having to sort of go through layers of insurance bureaucracy.
Hmm. Well, let's switch gears here and talk about Elizabeth Warren. I have been shocked at the almost erasure of Elizabeth Warren in the Iowa caucus. She came in third before Joe Biden, which I thought was a story. And yet it was mostly about Amy Klobuchar and her rise. John, you have a piece, The Media Clomentum and the Erasure of Elizabeth Warren. Vox also has a story, Elizabeth Warren's Once Promising, Now Imperiled Campaign Explained. And I noticed that Politico especially has really criticized Elizabeth Warren after the last couple months. So what has happened here, John?
I think, as I wrote in my piece, that momentum with an M, not a clo, is a big explainer of I think, what we've seen in coverage of Elizabeth Warren and also in coverage of Amy Klobuchar. I think that, you know, the sort of horse race model, which is obsessed with polls and electability and similar notions that we've already discussed on this program, is also obsessed with the kind of dynamics of how different campaigns are doing, right? You're either up or you're down at a given moment. Now, of course, dynamics do matter. I don't think anyone would claim otherwise. And looking at individual polls in isolation without appreciating directions of travel would obviously be a bad way of looking at polls. But it's not the whole story, especially when it gets kind of flattened out by by much medical coverage into this kind of oversimplified, as I said, up or down equation. And Warren is seen to be trending down, I think. She was up last summer, and I think got a lot of favorable coverage during that period. But since then, her support started to slide, and now she's on the way down, and that's kind of the narrative. It's kind of boxing her in. Klobuchar, to a certain extent, we're seeing go the other way, and so the narrative around her, again, overly simplistic, is that she's up. And so, in the end, the result of that is you see Warren and Klobuchar getting certainly not identical, but similar-ish results in Iowa and New Hampshire, respectively. Warren, as you mentioned, finishing third in Iowa, Klobuchar finishing third in New Hampshire. And yet, Klobuchar's third place is as good as a victory in literally kind of the words of certain pundits. Whereas Warren's campaign is seen to be on life support. And, you know, I think that's it's a grotesque oversimplification of the state of those respective campaigns, frankly.
Bronco, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a case to be made that maybe Warren's third place finish, which did overperform what the polling was saying, you know, maybe should have been covered a little more. But honestly, I don't really see much of an erasure of her. I mean, she went into that primary with the Iowa caucuses with not just the endorsement of the New York Times, of course, together with Klobuchar, which is another discussion we could have, but also the Des Moines Register endorsement. You know, January saw a debate where CNN debate moderator basically sided with Warren in what was essentially a he said, she said issue over, you know, what was said in that private meeting between Sanders and Warren. You know, there were the post-debate, people basically said, you know, the way that the Warren campaign was painting it was exactly the way it was. So, I mean, I think some of the other stuff people decided to point out this erasure is that her speech after New Hampshire wasn't played live, whereas Joe Biden's is. I mean, I'd say in that one, Warren did come fourth. It was a very poor showing in New Hampshire, and a state she should have done well. You know, her demographic tends to be skewed affluent and more white. I don't know if she would have really wanted more coverage of the fact that she came fourth in that. But having said that, there's also definitely a case to be made that, you know, this entire campaign, we have watched the media bounce from one candidate to another, one sort of chosen favorable candidate. You know, you had Kamala Harris that sort of went to Warren for a while, and she rose in the polls, and it jumped to Buttigieg, and now it's Klobuchar. And you know, you're absolutely right. Klobuchar was, despite really, really very low polling up until now, she has been for months hyped by pundits and television personalities as someone who really has a finger on the pulse of the electorate, as someone who could really beat Trump. Even when the polling didn't reflect it, you know, in those debates when she was polling it in the very, very low single digits, she would be getting a lot of speaking time, much more than other candidates who were polling around the same, you know, for example, Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang. So there definitely is, you know, the media, and I don't know if it's necessarily even to do with, you know, bias or favoritism. I kind of feel like it's just the media is, you know, a dog kind of chasing the next shiny thing. And, you know, they happen to have settled on Klobuchar, who exhibits all the kind of characteristics that pundits associate with what makes a good politician. You know, she's centrist and, you know, the doesn't have any too big radical ideas. She can work across the aisle, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think, you know, if we're talking about the media coverage, if we're talking about how it should be conducted in future campaigns, I think that's one thing that you know, should probably change. Whether it will, that's a whole other question.
Well, the Center for Biological Diversity just put out a scorecard. They're a great environmental organization. We're going to have them on Wednesday's show. And I didn't know much about Amy Klobuchar and her record, but she got the worst grade from the Center for Biological Diversity. She got a D. And they looked at Biden, Buttigieg, Sanders, Steyer, Warren, and Yang. They don't have Bloomberg on here yet, but we're going to talk about that on Wednesday, because I feel like now that the media are covering her more, we're hearing more about Mayon Bell. This is an African-American teenager who was sentenced to life in prison over the 2002 murder of 11-year-old Taisha Edwards, and Klobuchar led the case against Burrell when she was the district attorney. Actually, she was asked about it on The View, of all places. And now The View question has been turned into a big story. So we will definitely continue to cover that. But I just wanted to mention that because it's starting to get more attention. Today, we are talking about media coverage of the presidential primaries. John Alsop writes the Columbia Journalism Review's newsletter, The Media Today, and Bronco Marchatich is staff writer at Jacobin and a contributor to In These Times. Let's go to a few other callers, and we've got a lot of emails. Let's hear from Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. You know, I've been listening on my phone, not my radio, for probably a half an hour since I got in to the ask my question. And my question is, how come nobody has mentioned Michael Bloomberg's most recent ad that features Barack Obama apparently endorsing his candidacy? Or if not actually endorsing his candidacy, but being in the ad, and there has been no response from the media? Even your screener was amazed that ad actually exists, and yet it's been running for the last week on an almost daily basis, five or six times or more a day.
Well, thank you for that, and sorry you had to hold for so long, but thank you for holding. Yeah, that ad is getting a lot of attention on social media, and we should say this is not an endorsement from Barack Obama, but he did put Obama in the ad, and according to Salon, Biden was also nearby, but he cut Biden out. John or Bronco, any thoughts on that?
I can't say I've seen that particular ad, but you know, I think it's interesting because it plays into the question of who Barack Obama is going to endorse. Obama's sort of been this this meta figure in this whole campaign where a lot of the discussion has been actually about the Obama administration and some of its failures without Obama being named, because Obama, of course, is personally very popular, very influential within the Democratic Party. Nobody wants to actually attack him. But I think, this ad to me kind of reflects this duality in this campaign. On the one hand, everyone kind of wants Obama's endorsement, and there's been a lot of talk about what exactly his role in this election is going to be. Of course, there was that report a couple of months back in Politico that basically was talking about how Obama was alarmed at Sanders' rise and planned to step in and do something in case it looked like he was going to win. Of course, we've seen Obama make comments previously that seem to be kind of aimed at Sanders, saying that old men need to kind of step aside. Reportedly, he's also not particularly happy about Elizabeth Warren either. I don't think she's I think she's a little further left than he'd like as well. So, I mean, again, I haven't seen this ad, but Obama, you know, maybe potentially supporting Bloomberg is not out of the question, I think. I think that the two share a lot of their politics and their worldview more than people might think.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the call. And just for those who are curious, I just found the ad, and he's touting his ties to Obama. And it opens with clips of Obama introducing Bloomberg at an event in 2013 and goes to list Bloomberg's work with Obama on gun safety and education. So thank you for calling in, Raul, with that question. We've got a lot of emails. I'll just read a few and then get your final thoughts. Steve says, the coverage about Bernie and Elizabeth has been horrendous. The press and the DNC are desperately trying to derail Bernie and Warren. I am devastated at what is happening. Let's see. We have a lot of people writing to say, please do shows about candidates and their policies. Deborah says, aren't you doing the very same thing you accuse the mainstream of doing? If this keeps up, the progressive press attacking the moderates and the moderates attacking the progressives, we will have all media outlets to blame when Trump wins the next election. We've got a lot of comments about stop and frisk. Jones says, I think Bloomberg should be in the debates because his views can be exposed. Elizabeth and Amy are salivating to go after his policy. I'm sure Bernie is too. We have some criticism about NPR. Henry just wrote a very long piece. He sent a message to NPR about Mara Liasson regularly disparaging Bernie, and he is saying that she should not be covering the primary. We have another a criticism for NPR from a listener who says, I've been a longtime listener. While listening to their New Hampshire live coverage, there was constant degrading of Bernie and what he accomplished. So final thoughts, Bronco, in the coming months, now that we've got next Wednesday is a debate in Nevada. They're going to be voting on February 22nd. South Carolina is February 29th. And then you've got a lot of states, including California, on Super Tuesday, March 3rd.
One of the things that strikes me about this election so far is how much it's eerily mirroring the Republican primary of 2016, except now on the Democratic side. And in both cases, you have this, I guess, outsider candidate that is now leading the pack, who has a solid support base, arguably more in touch with the party's grassroots than the other candidates. Then you also have an establishment kind of freaking out about it. You're seeing this, and there's been many columns and write-ups across the political spectrum of people saying, you know, Sanders is unelectable and so on and so forth. Very similar to how they treated Trump. And just as with Trump, you know, you had this establishment paper tiger. You know, it was Jeb Bush for the Republicans in 2016. You have Joe Biden, it seems like, for Democrats. Now you have, instead of a unified coalescing around a single establishment candidate to prevent the outsider, you have the centrists and the establishment, the Democratic establishment candidates splitting the vote amongst themselves and attacking each other, and ultimately giving you know, the more populist candidate a route. So I based on what's happened so far, I expect, and you know, I don't want to predict, but it does seem like the rest of this primary is going to kind of follow the pattern of 2016 Republican primary, you said, in some ways.
Well, thank you so much. We are out of time. Thanks to Bronco Marchetich and John Alsop. Thanks to Jonathan Linden for line producing, David Latulipe, our studio engineer. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.